Hey guys, it's Jessica, founder of Noonday Collection. Welcome to the You Matter podcast. On this podcast, I want you to get ready to be inspired to be more courageous and to own your worth. Get ready to feel connected to the artisan community and to the community where you have a place of belonging, the ambassador community. Because the truth is, you matter, and I'm so glad you're here. Welcome to the conversation. It's Jessica, and I'm super excited to be here this week with you all. And I know you guys have, I've let y'all in on my journey with body image, and kind of, I really want us to be a part of expanding the definition of beauty in our culture and at our trunk shows and for other women. And a couple of years ago, when I realized, you know what, I'm having a hard time, I'm kind of feeling stuck in this journey of healing, and I realized I needed to reach out. And so at that time, I was like, I think it's time for me to go to therapy. And, you know, as culturally accepted therapy is now, it still was a vulnerable moment for me to kind of reach out and look for a therapist. But I knew that I wanted someone who really does work with women in regards to overcoming body image, dieting issues, eating disorder histories. And so I found that in my therapist, Kathleen Cho, and that's who I have here with us today. And so I really wanted to invite her today, and I'm so excited because normally during our sessions, I'm doing all the talking, and this time I get to get her to do a lot of the talking. And so I'm excited because I usually interrupt her a lot during our sessions and talk. Oh, wait, I've got this. And so no interruptions today. This gets to just be hearing her thoughts. So, you know, as Noonday ambassadors, we have the constant opportunity to expand our definition of beauty. And whether that means we're posting a selfie on Instagram to show our community how to style a certain accessory, or whether we're at a trunk show helping another woman to feel beautiful in her own skin, we are given a powerful opportunity as ambassadors. And all of us have these insecurities, and we all tell ourselves stories. And I talked about that at Shine. And so we're just going to be talking a little bit more today about how we can tell ourselves truer stories. So as you are sitting around during your days talking with women, sitting in front of you, what are some of the repeated messages you hear about how we as women are allowing, what are we allowing, how are we allowing others to define beauty for us? And how can we challenge our assumptions that are often rooted in our past or in our culture and in our perceptions?
I think what's shocking and saddening for me is how the women in my office don't question the standards they've internalized about beauty. They tell me that they feel ugly or fat or inadequate, and they don't seem to think that there's anything wrong with the cultural, the standard. They always assume that there's something wrong with them, that they're not meeting the standard. And I think trying to challenge that assumption that this is not like gravity. I mean, gravity is universal. We don't argue with gravity, but our cultural definition of beauty right now, especially in the Western Hemisphere, is the most narrow it's ever been. Mm-hmm. It's that double zero, that angular kind of prepubescent male, no curves, a flat stomach, you know, jutting hip bones. Yeah. It's not a body that women were designed to have. And if you think even about the broader implication of the woman's body, if you would choose to decide to nurture life, to have a child, that to not be able to be curvy, to not be able to have a stomach that would hold a uterus, that would hold a baby, to not have breasts that could nourish or feed a child, that we literally have disowned in some ways the very things that make us feminine and soft and women, curvy, that is not a celebrated body type anymore. You know, you look at the Renaissance paintings, these women were voluptuous. Mm-hmm. And that was a standard of beauty as well as of success. Mm-hmm. If you had weight on your body, you were wealthy. You didn't have to work. You had access to food. And they kind of, some of my European relatives actually feel kind of sorry for us. They think that we're all just working too hard and don't have enough to eat because we all look so thin to them.
Yeah. And but what would you say to the woman who feels more insecure about having a boy type body? Because I know when I shared my blob story at Shine, which mm-hmm. I've shared and with you, mm-hmm. you know, everyone related to it. You know, but for me, there was shame in being at the back of the line, being the heaviest girl at camp at the back of the line. But I had several women come up to me and say, I was at the front of the line and I felt just as shameful about that. So what do you think are these underlying issues that even trigger shame in regards to body image in us as women?
That is a really good point, Jessica, because I actually was rather thin and developed late as a child. And I was on a community swim team and I was asked by a boy on the team if I was a boy or a girl. Mm. And I remember just being devastated that he couldn't tell. And I had a swim cap on, so he probably didn't see my hair. But still, just really struggling with, I don't look like a girl. You know, I don't have hips. I don't have curves yet. And so I do think that there is just this lack of acceptance of different body types, of genetic makeup. If you ever see a family walking down the street, you can kind of tell they go together because their build is similar, right? So much of our body type is determined by our genetic makeup and then influenced by our eating habits, of course. But just a broader acceptance of that bodies come in all shapes and sizes, and there isn't an ideal body or a body that says, you know, this is a sexy woman or a beautiful woman. As opposed, men struggle the same way, right? The men that I work with body image, they want to be bulky, right? Mm-hmm. They want to be they're prone and vulnerable to taking steroids. They want to be bigger, and women want to be smaller. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And there's just not an acceptance of just the delightful variety that bodies come in. Instead of celebrating that, we kind of all want that one look mm-hmm. that's really only attainable for a very small percentage of the population.
And maybe it's like the look that, you know, whoever we're comparing ourselves to that day is the look that we're wanting.
Right.
And when you think about some of the women that you counsel and that you see, and when we're in a stuck place as women in our body image, how do you begin to move past that? Like, what are some of the first steps that you begin to take with your clients to challenge this assumption that they're making? Because like you said, oftentimes we're just going along with the standard and we think that were the body's the problem, and that if the body was fixed, then I know for me, I equated my body with being acceptable, with being accepted. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, if I had this certain body type, basically all my problems would be solved. You know, life would be perfect if I was a size 4 with great boobs and great waist or whatever. So how do you begin to sort of help people challenge these assumptions that we are having about ourselves?
That's a great question. And it really involves sort of several steps. The first one is really helping people to see that it's much more about the internal landscape. It's much more about self-image, self-esteem, self-acceptance, confidence, how you view yourself, than about anything external to you. And my really underweight anorexics hate their bodies just as much as my binge eaters that are carrying extra weight that would be overweight sort of by health standards, that would qualify even for perhaps an obesity. And my heavier clients just are in utter disbelief that if they didn't achieve that ideal body type, that their problems wouldn't simply vanish, or that they wouldn't be happy with their bodies. And yet, if they're ever in disordered eating recovery or in a group, they hear the anorexics disparage their bodies and hate their bodies, and they can't believe it, but it's happening around mm-hmm. them. So I really try to encourage people to stop focusing on size, shape, appearance as a way to achieve that sense of value and worth or beauty or acceptance or success, and really start focusing on what are you truly unhappy with about yourself that is blocking you from experiencing enjoyment of being who you are, who you were designed to be. Mm-hmm. It's also about relationship. I find we don't often think about having a relationship with food, but unlike substance abuse or alcoholism, where the addict can make a choice to abstain from that, whatever their substance of abuse is a substance of choice. With eating disorders, we have to be able to manage a relationship with food throughout our lifetime. We can't simply decide not to eat. Right. And so many of the 12-step programs, like Overeaters Anonymous, focus on some form of abstinence as being the way forward, and it simply becomes another set of rules to follow that don't have any freedom. It's just avoiding processed foods or white flour or sugar, and it just becomes another way to diet and be unhappy with yourself and fail, because we know that the diets have a 92% failure rate. It's the only product on the market that's still on the market with a failure rate of that type. But we believe in diets because we believe that if we follow certain rules, we will achieve the body that society tells us we should have, and then fill in the blank. Then I'll be successful. Then I'll get married. Then I'll get a promotion. Then I'll like myself. Then other people will like me. Mm-hmm. There's just so many magical things that we think will happen when we achieve this certain body type, and it becomes our focus and our obsession. Mm-hmm. So acceptance is really the first key. Acceptance that this is the body I have right now. Mm-hmm. And acceptance doesn't mean I like this or I want this or it's a good thing even to me, but acceptance means this is what it is. This is what I'm starting with. Can I put my energy towards that acceptance piece, and then I can look at how might I like my body better if I just took better care of it? If I did get some exercise, or I did eat in a more healthy way, if I ate foods that were nourishing or gave me energy, because we value what we take care of, and we take care of what we value. So even the act of starting to take care of our bodies instead of just hating them and hiding them and punishing them. Even binge eating can be a form of punishment. I hate myself. I hate my body. I'm just going to stuff myself.
Yeah.
And then feel even worse about myself.
So we value what we take care of, and we take care of what we value.
Right.
Yeah. I feel like as I look back over my last couple of years, which I'm still smack in the middle of the journey, I feel like some days I'm further along than others. It's funny. I was just meeting with some friends this morning, and one of my friends that is similar to me in our struggles with body image and food and coming out of a history of dieting. And I said, you know, I'm kind of in the fashion industry, so this is in my face. And it's like an alcoholic that owns a bar. Like, you know, like I'm in it. But then there's also something so powerful about that. Why I wanted to actually just be able to have this conversation for our ambassadors, because it's like what you said, we can't abstain from food, you know, and as women, we can't just abstain from our culture. And if you think about Noonday, we are about beauty and style and accessorizing other women and helping other women feel beautiful. So when you think about sort of the position that an ambassador's in, you know, they're basically, you know, women are their clients, they're going to trunk shows every week, they're right smack dab in those moments when a woman's looking in the mirror and saying, oh, my neck, it's got wrinkles on it, or this or that. You know, how would you define confidence? Like, what is a confident woman? Where does that come from? How can we become more confident women? And then how can we help other women become more confident?
That's a great question, Jess, because I think confidence has to come from within. I basically feel that I have value and worth. I'm likable or lovable, that I'm good at relationships. I'm good at caring for people. I'm good at letting people care for me, that it has so little to do with appearance. If you look at people with disabilities or disfigurement from burns, and some of them are the most joyful people you will ever meet because they've kind of figured out what really matters, that they kind of figured out, I can do life without a leg or both legs. I can do life with this scar on my face or my body because I'm so much more than that. And I'm not going to let that define me. I'm not going to let people feel sorry for me. Mm-hmm. And I think that's so powerful for us because, you know, we want to get plastic surgery on wrinkles, perhaps, which is amazing that the aging process is so so feared and so resisted. It's something that happens to us all. It's not limited to certain races or certain socioeconomic status. Aging is universal, and yet we are fighting it tooth and nail and spending billions on, you know, trying to remain youthful. You know, why is there not value in wrinkles that are hard earned, in laugh lines, in being outside, you know, in the sun? And maybe we've, you know, earned those wrinkles because we've been active and busy and done things with our bodies and used our bodies. And to support each other as women, I think, is to stop letting each other talk about the neck or, you know, the part of our body that we don't like, and instead to focus on how beautiful we are to each other because of who we are rather than what we look like, to emphasize each other's, perhaps someone has a very gentle spirit or a caring heart or is a great strategist or a visionary or a problem solver. And, you know, we tend to say, you look so nice today, or that looks great on you, instead of, you know, describing or encouraging or applauding perhaps a quality someone has or a success that someone has had, or, you know, focusing on what are we doing. But for men, it's so much more about success and accomplishment and tasks, right? Achievements.
Right.
And it's little less common to say to a man, oh, you look great today. You know, that's a great pair of pants, right?
And it doesn't mean that much to him.
Exactly.
I mean, the dude's more about like, what do you do for a living?
He doesn't define himself by his appearance. So how do we take in the whole woman?
Yeah.
How do we take her in as a person with gifts and talents and strengths and weaknesses, where that perfectionism, we have to drive a stake through it. To be human is to fail. To be human is to not be perfect. And I heard an interview with a model once that she basically said, you know, I'm cashing in on my genetic makeup. I had nothing to do with this. I didn't create this body and these facial features and this hair. I was born with this, and I'm making a living off of it, but it doesn't make me special.
Right.
I didn't do anything to achieve this. This was given to me. And, you know, just for her to be so honest about that and to let women know we don't get to choose our genetic makeup and our body type. We can perhaps choose how we care for our bodies in a way that keeps it healthy and strong. But the basic bone structure and height and type of body that we have, that was determined long before we were born,
right,
to speak. And how are we going to celebrate that and enjoy that?
Yeah. I want to go back to what you said right after I asked this question. You said some phrases like, I can carry on a great conversation. I'm likable. I'm worthy. Those are not phrases that naturally go through our heads as women. You know, normally we might be getting ready for a trunk show or getting ready for a day, and we're focused on, you know, I woke up too late and so I didn't get to get the best breakfast made for my kids, or I didn't get enough exercise in today, or we go to a trunk show and we think, maybe I'm not gonna be able to sell as much as I really need to tonight. It's like that scarcity thing. And so, first of all, why is that? Like, are we wired to sort of have this not enough thing? And then what do we do? I mean, is it just kind of that, like, becoming aware that we're having these conversations with ourselves and then just being able to kind of, you know, talk about this with one another?
I think underlying all of that negative self-talk is a universal myth that women labor under today, that I have to be perfect, that I can have it all, I can do it all, and not only that, but I can do it all perfectly. And that my kids have to have the power breakfast and the designer backpacks and the homework signed, and I have to, you know, have run my 5 miles and had my shower and maybe, you know, read something inspirational and be dressed to the nines and show up calm and rested and you know, on my A game. And, you know, that's just, we would have to be robots to accomplish that. We're human. We forget things. We get tired. We get sick. We get discouraged. We have a personal life with issues in it. Maybe, you know, we had a fight with our husband that morning. Maybe the cat ran away. You know, there's so many things that we can't control in our environment that we would have to be able to control, including weather and traffic, in order to have a perfect life. And I think accepting that it is not a failure to fail. It is human. It's human to fail. And are we even failing? Are the standards that we're setting, again, you know, there are certain things that are universal, like the earth being round. It was always round. Even when people thought it was flat, it was round. Gravity is universal. We can't really argue with it. But these standards, we accept them as though there's some kind of law that has been written and is true for everyone. And these are just expectations that we've created or that we've allowed others to create for us. And then we measure ourselves against them. And we look at the people who we think are accomplishing them, and we don't know how much Xanax they're taking to do that, right? But we assume somehow that they're doing better, they're managing life better, they're more successful, and it brings up all that inadequacy. Mm-hmm. The twin myths that women struggle with is I'm not enough, mm-hmm. not good enough, not sexy enough, not accomplished enough, not smart enough, or I'm just too much. I'm too overwhelming. Mm-hmm. I have too many problems. I talk too much. I am too much. Mm-hmm. And then we struggle with those twin messages, and we can't seem to find a place in the middle that just accepts our strengths and weaknesses and our beauty as women for who we are.
When you think about the clients you see that are sort of able to move past, like they're able mm-hmm. to not stay stuck. Mm-hmm. I mean, hopefully that's a lot of your clients. What are some of those key principles that they're taking away or that they're applying to their lives that are helping them to be more resilient and sort of embracing their imperfections and overcoming some of this unicorn mentality, I think, that we have?
That's a great phrase. I think it's the concept of good enough.
Okay.
I think it's being adequate and good enough rather than always being perfect.
Okay.
I think it's accepting we cannot control outcomes. Letting go of outcomes is huge for my female clients, mm-hmm. that all you can manage is your preparation. You can be prepared for whatever it is you're going into. You can try to get good rest and eat well and you know, be as organized as possible. But so much of how whatever plays out, whether it's a meeting, a parent-teacher conference, a sales presentation, a marathon, you know, whatever you're doing, there are so many variables that you won't be able to control that won't be your failure if it doesn't go the way that you had hoped it would go. Of course, we all want things to go well. We mm-hmm. want to succeed. But for us to say that this is my fault, it's a little bit like saying I'm God and mm-hmm. I could control all of these variables to get the perfect outcome. We influence outcomes. We don't control
them. And I think that's been huge for me. And I know I've said this a lot to our ambassadors is, you know, that you've said that anxiety is the fear of a certain outcome. And then we attach our identity to that outcome. Mm-hmm. And I know for me, my journey of really self-acceptance began when I truly surrendered an outcome of a thin body. Mm-hmm. And I spent, you know, my first diet was at 6 years old, Weight Watchers. And then I've spent, you know, I think I started coming to you a couple years ago. I'm 39. So, I mean, a good 30-something years mm-hmm. of using, you know, dieting and then fixating on this outcome that I've got to put all this energy into achieving this body mm-hmm. because then life will be better. And I think it was really when I was willing to let go of the outcome and that maybe part of my journey was like not going to be about having this body that I had in my mind is really where it began. And I think that's a lot of what you challenge is this whole dieting thing. Sometimes I feel like I'm arguing with you in my head during the week when I'm not even seeing you. But how do we strike this balance? Because, you know, some of us have come from compulsive dieting backgrounds, you know, and so we really, and we've used it as a form of control. And so there's a place of needing to let go. But then there's other women, I know I hear this on our Facebook page, that struggle with emotional eating. Mm-hmm. And that's especially hard for our jobs as ambassadors because we have these trunk shows a couple times a week. There's snacks, there's drinking, you know, so it's something that's in our faces a lot. So mm-hmm. how do we as women, you know, you said earlier, we take care of what we value what we take care of. Mm-hmm. So, but how do you, because you have some clients that are more emotional eaters and they need boundaries. They need to learn moderation is not a bad word. Mm-hmm. And then you have some clients that, you know, come from more anorexic backgrounds, that dieting has been their form of control and salvation. I mean, it seems like a maze to me mm-hmm. sometimes.
Right. And I think what's really important to remember that that's the arena that the issues are playing out in, but the issues aren't actually about food.
Okay.
They aren't actually about the body. That those issues are emotional in nature. Most people that struggle with disordered eating really struggle to identify emotion, express emotion, and deal with emotion. Emotion is meant to come up and pass through a feeling. It's basically a chemical reaction. A positive emotion involves serotonin. It involves releases of dopamine, oxytocin. A negative emotion involves releases of cortisol and adrenaline and the kind of fight or flight types of responses. So an emotion is essentially a chemical reaction that's happening in response to a belief or a meaning we've assigned to whatever is happening in our life at that moment. If we fear conflict, if we have abandonment issues or fear a terrible fear of rejection, which none of us enjoy rejection, then we, if we are in a situation where we perceive that those things are happening, we are going to have a negative emotional response. And then for our emotional eaters, they are going to seek comfort, possibly in food, because food has a kind of a sedating, kind of numbing effect. That the food has nothing to do with the core issue, which might be abandonment or rejection. Their body is not physically hungry. Food is primarily fuel and secondarily enjoyment or celebration. That's a really helpful mindset to have. So if I'm not physically hungry and I am eating, I'm really literally eating my feelings. And the problem with eating my feelings is that I haven't allowed the feeling to come up
to pass through.
I've stuffed it with food, literally. I've stuffed it down. That emotion's just going to come back. So I may have to eat it again. Also, though, I've now generated negative feelings about myself. Most of my women that eat emotionally feel shame, they feel disgust, they feel lack of control or willpower, they feel really unhappy with themselves. And if I have to eat my negative emotions, and now my eating has created negative emotions, I'm locked in this cycle where I'm continually having to eat more, feel worse about myself, eat more. And it, so it just becomes a trap for women. And they've never addressed that. That core issue is, what do I actually believe is happening to me right now? Because the body gets such a bad rap. Women hate their bodies, but their bodies can't reach for food unless the brain tells it to. The body isn't the one that's craving the brownie. It's the brain saying, that looks good and it will make you feel better. Even though that's very fleeting, right? How long is the brownie actually in your mouth?
Right.
And then how long are you going to carry the bad feelings after you've eaten it, if you do, if that's your response? If you feel like I failed my diet or cheated or broken my rule or whatever is going on in that moment. So I often will ask a client to write a letter from her body to her mind, to herself, and let the body express what it's like to always be blamed for her unhappiness, when the body's actually really just doing the best it can to cope with the way it's being dealt with, which is either being starved. A lot of my clients that overeat go through periods then of deprivation, of restriction, to punish themselves for overeating. And it's this feast and famine cycle that the body just has to cope with, even though that's not a healthy cycle for the body to deal with. So it's really, an eating disorder, the E should really stand for emotions. It shouldn't stand for eating. We're expressing that issue through food and our relationship with our body. We could just as well be expressing it with a gambling addiction, pornography, sexual addiction, alcohol, drugs. It's just a different arena.
Right. I think it's hard that I think we say the word eating disorder. It feels heavy. It feels like maybe the people that really identify with that can relate. But how do you define? I was the other night, talking to a friend who's trying out a new diet because she really is feeling like I put on some weight and I just can't get it off. And I don't know. It's like I struggle with this idea of health.
Sure.
And wanting to encourage women to be healthy and to treat themselves well by what they eat. But then it feels like it's just one degree off from kind of this regimented, So what percentage of women do you think sort of struggle with disordered eating?
That's a good question, because I agree that, a certain percentage of the population actually qualifies for the diagnosis, right? That meets the criteria for an eating disorder. But I would say, honestly, a majority of women struggle with disordered eating or some form of disordered, body image or relationship with food. Unfortunately, it seems to touch many, many, if not most women at some point in their lives. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, for women to recognize that they if they have been, I call it chaotic eating, if they've been eating in a way that is either restrictive or perhaps even the kind of more binge eating or overeating, it's very difficult to move to the goal for me with my clients is what I call intuitive eating, that the premise is the body knows what it needs. If you've ever tried to feed a baby past the point of fullness, they're pretty adamant about pushing the bottle or the breast or the spoon away. It's very difficult to overfeed a baby. At the same time, when they're hungry, they're going to let you know. Mm-hmm. They're going to cry until you take care of the hunger. Over time, we start to lose that intuitive connection with our hunger and fullness. We start to eat for reasons other than physical hunger. We eat because we're sad. We eat to celebrate. We eat out of boredom. We eat the classic, picture of the girls not invited to the prom. They're all on the floor eating a carton of ice cream, right? We're eating together. We're sort of sharing our sorrow, right? Drowning our sorrow in ice cream. So we stop. We don't eat when we're hungry, right? If we think we're carrying extra weight or everyone around us is dieting and we don't feel right about eating because no one else at the table is eating and we're hungry, we're going to deny that hunger, right? So we don't eat when we're hungry. We do eat when we're not hungry, and we completely lose touch with that intuitive sense of physical hunger and fullness because we're eating emotionally now. Mm. And so if women have been eating that way for many years, it's very difficult to tell them, trust your hunger.
Right.
Eat when you're hungry, stop when you're full. They have no idea what that looks like. Uh-huh. So the meal plan can be a good bridge between uh-huh. chaotic eating and intuitive eating. And a meal plan would involve getting some education from a nutritionist, or there's someone who can show you portions, can show you food mm-hmm. groups, can help you get in touch with what does my body actually need? A woman of my size, my height, mm-hmm. my bone structure, my activity level, what would be sort of an average amount of food that would sustain me well, give me energy, keep me strong over the course of a day or a week. And that's really helpful information. I think there's so much misinformation out mm-hmm. there that women think they know right. how to eat, but we really don't have a clue uh-huh. anymore, really how to feed ourselves well. We're so confused by all of the misinformation that we've been given. Right. So I encourage women to throw out the diet, because a diet is a set of rules that will create deprivation and a sense of failure if we break the rules. Mm-hmm. And a diet, I feel like, is just reliant on willpower, and willpower is fleeting. Willpower will fail us eventually. We'll get stressed, we'll get tired, we'll get overwhelmed, we'll get bored mm-hmm. with the diet. We'll cheat on the diet, so to speak. And so if we're not on a diet, if we're on a plan, if we're on a lifestyle, essentially, mm-hmm. there's no cheating, there's no failing. It's just a constant kind of pursuit of a healthy relationship mm-hmm. with food and the body.
It almost gives us permission to then... Because I know for me, it's like it takes a lot of energy to be on a diet,
sure.
to restrict your eating, mm-hmm. In a way that you're cooking differently for yourself than your family, and you're having to think about the weekend. And I mean, it takes a lot of planning and energy. And I find that when I was doing that so much, then that energy wasn't going to like my ultimate healing. Mm-hmm. It's like it's a cover for getting in touch with those emotions mm-hmm. and becoming aware. Right. And like, I think that's what you said earlier is the first step that you see with that your clients that are able to be resilient is coming to that place of self-acceptance, mm-hmm. which can be a kind of a scary thing
sure.
because you think acceptance mean, well, does that mean I have to, am I going to look like this forever? Mm-hmm. Like if I accept myself, does that mean this is what I'm going to be like. Mm-hmm. I know I really struggled with that. Mm-hmm. How do you define acceptance?
So acceptance basically is it is what it is. This is what it is. This is my body right now. It's this weight. It's this size. It's this many inches or, kind of however you're sort of looking at your body type or your body shape. And the irony to me is that women say, I can't be in this body, or this is not acceptable to me, but they are, they're in it. They've been doing life in this body for years. Many women, by the time they come to me, they've been at this weight they're unhappy with for a long time. And most of them aren't, locked in a closet. I mean, they're working and they're raising kids and they're married or single, but they're doing their life in this body. So I always find it a little bit ironic when someone says to me, this is unacceptable. I can't do this, or I can't be here. Or, I can't stay here. And I want to tell them, but you've been doing this
been.
Actually fairly successfully. So I think it's that moving away from that urgency. Okay. It's moving away from the panic that mm-hmm. this is not a crisis. You know, you're unless it is. I mean, I do have clients that really are, they're pre-diabetic or they are diabetic. They're running into some serious health issues, mm-hmm. and that can happen with smoking and alcohol and addictions. And we get to a point where it's a wake-up call, right? The doctor says, okay, you know, if you continue down this path, you're going to die, basically. Mm-hmm. And that can feel like more of an emergency situation. But even then, we don't operate well out of panic. We're in the survival part of our brain. Mm. We're in the fight or freeze, you know, base mm. of our brain. We're not thinking clearly. We're not able to make a plan. We're just reacting. And we can't just stop eating, right? We'll die. And we can't even drastically reduce our food intake because our body goes into famine mode. Our metabolism grinds to a halt and we defeat, you know, everything we're trying to accomplish because now we have such a slow metabolism that we can't move the weight anyway. Mm-hmm. And so that's where, again, it's accepting this is where I am and it's okay. I don't want to stay here and that's okay too. Mm-hmm. But how am I going to figure out what is keeping these behaviors in place rather than just trying to change the behavior? Behavior for your modification is not lasting. It is it doesn't last because it's not based on any internal transformation. Shift. Right. Mm-hmm. It's just me trying to change my behavior, again, using willpower, which we know is fleeting in most humans, even those with self-discipline, the willpower eventually will fail us. And it's figuring out this, I'm eating this way because it has served a purpose. Even if it's hard for me to see that purpose, even if it looks kind of crazy from the outside, all behavior meets a need. All behavior serves a purpose. We're not just random human beings.
Right.
We're purposeful, we're direction oriented. So we have to figure out how is eating this way, how have I incorporated this into managing my life, managing my emotions, managing my relationships, and how am I going to find healthier ways to do that? How am I going to find coping resources that don't involve food, that put food back in the place of fuel, primary fuel, and then secondarily celebration or enjoyment? Mm-hmm. Food has sort of become the avenue for dealing with everything that comes my way. If you have a flat tire and go to Taco Bell, you still have a flat tire.
Right.
You still have to change your tire.
Well, like we were saying earlier, it's socially acceptable. Mm-hmm. And more than like alcohol or drugs, right. We do. It's like, it's legal. We make jokes. Let's go eat a pint of ice cream. Mm-hmm. I'm depressed. Mm-hmm. You know, let's drink an extra margarita. Right. This week, it is so acceptable.
And that's when you mentioned moderation.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing really in life that we don't have to practice some moderation around, whether it's shopping or sex or sleeping or, you know, taking vacations. So why would food be different? Why do we resist that idea that, yes, we have to enjoy food in moderation, just like everything else? There's nothing in our life that doesn't become a problem for us if we overindulge in it.
Right.
Even work, right?
Right.
The workaholic.
Right. So I'm sure that there's women listening right now and they might be getting triggered. They might be thinking, oh gosh, I think I need to talk to someone. And so how can we, you know, I've been blessed to be able to afford therapy, but some women might not be in that place, mm-hmm. or some women might still be stigmatized by therapy. So that's one reason I wanted you to just come and share today was so that, you know, you guys, if there's any of y'all that are feeling like, you know, shame around needing to get outside help, that you'll go do it. Because I know for me, it's been extremely invaluable and continues to be. I'm still on this journey. You know, I used to say, I'll share this journey publicly when I'm healed, when I'm whole, when I'm perfect, mm-hmm. right? It was that perfectionism. And part of me just realized, you know, this is a journey that I'm on. And part of my healing is walking with others in it. So there's therapy. So maybe there's resources that people can go to for that. And then what else can we do to kind of create spaces for healing?
That's a great question, Jessica. And I think so much of it is starting to be more open with each other, that to not assume that you're alone with this struggle, whether it's overeating, undereating, binging and purging, body image, just feeling this overriding sense of inadequacy in parenting and marriage and singleness, just for us to just start being more open, to stop looking like we have it all together, to stop scouring our house before we have company so that everyone else feels bad when they come over because they could, you know, they're not going to have anyone over now because their house will never look like that. You know, we're so hard on ourselves, and it ends up making us hard on each other. To be willing to be open about, I yelled at my kids this morning, you know, I need a strategy to not lose my temper. Yeah. Or, you know, I did eat a whole pizza by myself last night. Mm-hmm. And to get permission, then call for a friend to say, just call me if you're mm-hmm. sad and lonely. Don't eat the pizza, call me. You know, we'll eat it together. We'll go for a walk.
Right.
To really start reaching out and realizing that if you've had this thought or this feeling, you can be guaranteed that someone else has had it as well.
That's so true. And that really is where the healing begins, when we can risk being vulnerable. It's vulnerability is the path to wholeness in so many ways.
Right.
Well, thank you so much for being willing to do this. And thank you guys for, y'all been a space for me. And I feel like that is what we're wanting to do, is create spaces for one another to be vulnerable, to be courageous. And when I think about a trunk show, it is really that spot where beauty intersects with confidence, you know, and where we really can expand our definition of beauty to include where, you know, your internal. And I think that, I know I see that when I travel all the time, you know, that beauty matters, you know, style matters. I think about the women in Africa who, when I first went and visited, they had really short haircuts because they couldn't afford haircuts or to get weaves. And then when I went back a year later, their jobs had enabled them to have fun with their braids mm-hmm. and with their weaves. But then also their jobs really enabled them to have a restoration of dignity and self-worth too. Mm-hmm. So I love what we're getting to do as ambassadors, and just thank you so much for today.
It's been a privilege and an honor. And Jessica, I want to say how brave you've been in your journey, that you've been willing to share it even while you're still on it. And that takes a lot of courage.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks so much for tuning in to this week's episode of You Matter. You guys know I want us all to be courageous women, and I think part of becoming courageous is being vulnerable, and that is something that, you know, you definitely have to choose to do. And so in opening up this conversation today, I mean, I know how many struggle, just research shows how many women struggle with food and with body issues. And so I would love to hear something that really resonated with you, maybe a new way for you to think about something. Maybe you could even share an area of insecurity for you and what you've done to kind of tell yourself a new story and a true story. And you can do that on our Facebook page and just hashtag it You Matter. And I can't wait to have us join in on this conversation. Thanks so much, guys.